From 90.5 WESA, I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and this is Essential Pittsburgh for Friday, March 6th. It's opening weekend for the August Wilson play How I Learned What I Learned at the Pittsburgh Public Theater. It's the Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright's final written work relating stories of his life as a young poet before he left the Hill District. Today we'll talk with director Todd Kreidler and Eugene Lee, who portrays Wilson in this one-man show. First up, in 2013, 1 in 7 Americans struggled with hunger, reaching kids in high-poverty rural areas and helping people get back to work to earn enough to feed their families is a major focus of a new USDA initiative announced this week. We'll talk with Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack. And later, why the space program is taking CMU students to the desert on today's Essential Pittsburgh after the news. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. It may be hard for some to believe, but in the United States, nearly 16 million households have to worry about where their next meal is coming from. In 2013, 1 in 7 Americans struggled with hunger. The problem of child hunger, particularly in rural communities throughout America and here in Pennsylvania, is all too real. The problem of reaching kids in high-poverty rural areas and helping people get back to work to earn enough to feed their families is a major focus of a new USDA initiative announced this week by U.S. Secretary of Agriculture and Pittsburgh native Tom Vilsack. He joins us now by phone from Washington. Secretary Vilsack, good to have you with us.
Paul, it's great to be with you.
What is important for our listeners to know about the extent of the problem of child hunger in America and in Pennsylvania?
Well, they're twin issues. First of all, you mentioned the households that are food insecure. 17 million kids live in those homes, and from time to time during the course of a month, there may not be adequate resources for the family to be able to feed all members of the family adequately. That's why it's important for us to have a comprehensive approach to hunger and to food insecurity. At the same time, you may also be confronted with the fact that a third of our youngsters are obese or at risk of being obese, so there's an obesity issue, which is also often tied to poverty. So USDA, under President Obama's direction, we're trying to focus on those twin problems in a very comprehensive and coordinated and thoughtful way. We've improved the WIMP and Infant Children package that impacts 53% of all newborns. We've expanded access to our Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program and encouraged folks to consume more fruits and vegetables and be able to access their SNAP cards at farmers markets and be able to purchase food from farmers markets. We've improved the school lunch program, and we've also expanded summer meals to make sure kids don't fall through the cracks during the summer. But there's still more work to be done.
What are the challenges in getting people to eat healthy foods, to educate themselves and make ultimately better dietary choices?
Well, one aspect is making sure people understand it doesn't necessarily have to be more expensive. I think there is the belief that fruits and vegetables and wholesome foods oftentimes are more expensive. That's not necessarily the case. That's why we have focused on providing families who are receiving SNAP and why we're focused in schools on figuring out ways in which we can stretch that food dollar and still have nutritious and healthy meals. A second issue is access. Oftentimes, folks find themselves far away from a full-scale grocery store. 23 million Americans live more than a mile away from a full-scale grocery store. And in remote rural areas, it can be that you're 10, 15, or 20 miles away from a full-scale grocery store, so you may only have access to a very limited number of wholesome options. So one of the reasons we are focusing on the SNAP program and access to farmers markets is to expand opportunities. We've also got a healthy finance initiative designed to try to address the issue of food deserts to help promote grocery stores in these poor rural areas and urban centers where there isn't a full-scale grocery store. It's why we focus on programs like the Summer Meals Program to supplement and amplify what we do at schools for kids.
You mentioned how this problem is the result of geographical challenges, but who is hit hardest by this?
Well, I would say that children are hit hardest because the reality is we know that if we focus on early childhood, if we focus on making sure kids get good choices early in life, that they're going to be less prone to chronic diseases, they're going to be more productive at school, they're going to have more success at school, and they're going to put themselves in a position to be productive adults. If we basically have situations where kids don't have access to nutritious food, if they don't have decent meals and three meals a day, when they don't have access at school because they are stigmatized as a free and lunch reduced kid, then oftentimes these kids don't get the kind of help and assistance they need, and they end up missing school. They end up not doing well in school. Hungry kids usually have a harder time learning. It's another reason why we focused even on expanded school breakfast and why we have a program now to take a look at maybe in some areas actually having to serve three meals a day for kids in the school setting.
How many of us tend to be in the dark about this? I'm guessing a lot of us would be surprised to hear, for example, that 76% of educators say their students regularly come to school hungry.
I think people are very, very much surprised by the level of food insecurity, the level of obesity, the challenges that many families face. And it's one of the reasons why we really focused in this administration on a whole scale and a comprehensive approach to trying to address these issues. You know, this whole issue of summer feeding, for example, it's something that mayors and governors, I've actually talked to Governor Wolf about this. He recognizes the problem in Pennsylvania. You know, kids get meals, they get breakfast, they get lunch at school, then summer comes and there's nothing. That's why we have a concerted effort to expand the number of sites and sponsorships of summer feeding sites. We pay for the meals at USDA. We just need a faith-based organization or a service organization or a city park and recreation department to assume the responsibility for sponsoring the site and making it available for kids during the summer months.
And here in Pennsylvania, school funding is tied to so many different issues that are related to school. How does it impact school lunches and nutrition, particularly during the school year, the funding issues?
Well, the challenges for rural communities in particular is meeting standards that have been set by the Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act to reduce the amount of sodium and sugar, the amount of fat, and basically improving meals so that there are more fruits and vegetables, more whole grains, more low-fat dairy. That's a challenge for some school districts, and we're trying to provide help and assistance. We're giving them school lunchroom grants that allow us to improve the technologies and techniques and recipes that are available. We're giving them equipment grants so they can produce food on-site instead of trucking it from a central kitchen. We're working with a number of schools that are struggling and trying to pair them up with schools that are succeeding in embracing these new standards, because it doesn't necessarily have to be that because you're having economic challenges or you've got a declining school enrollment and your school aid is being impacted, that you necessarily have to compromise or not be able to meet these standards. There are school districts faced with those same challenges that are succeeding at all of this. So we've been trying to provide help and assistance, and certainly Pennsylvania is no different than any other state.
Secretary Vilsack, I mentioned earlier you are a Pittsburgh native. You follow all of the Pittsburgh sports teams, especially the Pirates. How excited are you about their prospects this year?
Well, I am. I'm quite excited. I think everybody understands that we're going through a period of riches here with the Steelers regaining playoff form and the Penguins shoring up their defense a little bit with recent trades, and now the Pirates looking forward to having a solid eight every single day on the starting lineup and good pitching. It's great. It's good to see AJ come back to the city for one last go around, and hopefully the starting pitching holds up because we've got great relief pitching.
Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack, obviously a Pirates fan, joining us from Washington. Mr. Secretary, it's been a pleasure chatting with you. Good luck with the new USDA effort to fight child hunger.
Thanks, Paul. Take care.
More Essential Pittsburgh straight ahead. This is 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. How I Learned What I Learned is the last play Pulitzer Prize winner and Pittsburgh native August Wilson wrote before his death in 2005. It's been staged in other parts of the country, but now this one-man show is being performed for the first time in Mr. Wilson's hometown at the Pittsburgh Public Theater. It runs through April 5th, and I'm joined now in Studio A by the actor who stars as August Wilson in How I Learned What I Learned, Eugene Lee. Welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you.
Also with us is Director Todd Kreidler. Good to have you with us, Todd.
Thank you.
And you can join the conversation at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email is esspgh@wesa.fm and on Twitter at esspgh. Todd Kreidler, you worked for many years as August Wilson's dramaturg, and that's a term that describes the advisor who assists with research, adaptation, and development of plays. Talk about how you became August Wilson's collaborator, his trusted partner in these endeavors, how you met him and how you formed this close professional working relationship with him.
Sure. I met him here in Pittsburgh, actually October 26, 1999, first day of King Hedley, the second rehearsal, the world premiere of his new play that opened the O'Reilly Theater and brought the Pittsburgh Public Theater downtown. And I started as his assistant. I was put in a room with him, and it started out, I always say there was no job description, there was no art search for this. I was in a room with him, and it began very early on with a personal connection. Our first break after the first read-through, we went outside and he started telling me stories about when he was a cook at Little Brothers in St. Paul. And at some point the director comes out and he says, August, man, you coming to rehearsal? And he goes, yeah, we're on break. And he said, no, that was last break. You guys have been out here for 2.5 hours. And so that conversation sort of grew. And then probably the day that changed my life was he brought in a note card with a part of King's speech. And he said, Tom, man, he said, I know King says this in the play, man, but I don't know where it goes, man. Can you find a spot? And I was like, I'll find three. And, you know, we went outside and I showed him my, you know, first choice, got, you know, I saved my best for last. When we got to that, he was like, oh, man, that's great, man. The music fits in there, man. And then, oh, man, King says that, man. We know that, man. Go have stage management. Put that in. And then the next day was like, man, Tanya, man, now she's coming back from, like, you know, her job at the insurance company, man. But how do we know, blah, 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 blah. And then it just started like that. And then he invited me to Seattle. And then when in Seattle, he said, man, we got 6 more stops on King Hedley. And he said, till Broadway, do you want to go? And so I packed my stuff in storage and went on the road and, you know, it just grew like that. And the origin of the one-man show began in those, you know, 1999 Pittsburgh on that street corner. He was working on a one-man show, theoretically, called I'm Not Spalding Gray. And we started telling jokes and working up bits. And, you know, 2 years later, he called and he said, man, I think I talked myself into a show. And he said, I was in Seattle at a fundraiser and they offered us a spot and I need a director. And so in the summer of 2003, we did it originally with him performing, and we built the show together in his basement over, you know, a sleepless month in Seattle.
And I understand he even put a desk, he had a desk in his basement that he worked from or on, and he put a desk in there for you eventually.
Oh, yeah, that was one of the highlights of my life. When I turned the corner in his basement, because I'd worked in his basement many times before, and I would carve out a space on the edge of his desk. And so the day I went down and he had a printer for me and a monitor, and he's like, man, we got a lot of work to do, man. You need your own space. So when I earned that space, that was like, I don't know, a reward in life out there that could match that moment.
There was a substantial age difference between and August Wilson, who he was much older. In fact, he told his wife, Costanza Romero, that you were like the son he never had. That, I'm guessing, must mean a lot to you.
Yeah, absolutely.
In the last 5 years before August Wilson's death, you spent hours in the evening talking to him, often just over the phone. What did you guys talk about?
I don't think there's a corner of life we didn't touch on. It was a constant riff that would circle whatever we were working on at the time. Boy, we talked a lot about George Bush, and we talked a lot about the Palestinians and terrorism and art and philosophy. And then he would read pieces of the play. Like, it's hard to, his quality of mind is actually something that I think really comes out in the show and that Eugene really brings to life in the show, the way he can twist and turn. I always say that August is a blues man with a jazz mind. I mean, his mind is like Hamlet. It can turn and it can flip and then echo back in conversation. I think that's part of the spell that he cast in his storytelling. And you see that evidence in the plays, but I think you feel that in the one-man show too, the way you get this. It's not like this happened to me and then this happened to me, then this happened to me. It's like you sort of get inside the DNA of how he became who he became.
And it all began just from these conversations outside the O'Reilly Theater. What would it have been, 16 years ago now?
Almost, yeah, fall of 1999.
And so Eugene Lee, as you portray August Wilson in this work, I read that now that it's being performed in Pittsburgh, you're expecting a scrutiny that audiences in other cities might not have brought to the theater. Like what?
A familiarity, more than anything, and a kindred kindness with this man, and an awe for him that's kind of special. And, you know, when I say Crawford Grill, people here have an image. You know, if I'm in Atlanta and I say Crawford Grill, I'm talking about this place this far away called the Crawford Grill. But here it has a historical significance, and people have a memory. They have a connection to it. They've been there, for example. And so, yeah, it's that kind of familiarity. And, you know, then they hear names of people that they know that are here. And then there might be some of these people that I mentioned in the play that are actually in the audience on any given night. You know, so it's those kinds of perspectives and things that I think are going to make this play fun here.
And we're talking about, as we, you know, drill down into the essence of this play, we're talking about August Wilson's years in the Hill District. He's reflecting on his days in the mid-60s when he thought of himself primarily as a poet. So what are we learning in terms of the exploration of the creative process here? Is that part of this, or is it how he educated himself? Well, or all of the above?
That's a part of what this is. We, you know, he talks about having dropped out of school at the age of 15 and gone to the library.
I love that story.
For people
who don't know this, he literally stopped going to class and during the hours that he was supposed to be in school, he goes to the library every day
and sort of self-educated himself and you get an insight. And a perspective on how he did that, the process of going to the library and reading and following a trail of ideas and developing ideas and developing as a poet and making a concerted effort to improve himself as a poet and as a wordsmith and to be good at what he has decided to do with his life. You know, so you get those kinds of insights in this little piece, but you also get some insights into some foibles and some vulnerabilities and you know, the first kiss and things along those lines and all of these things and the people along the way, they are the inspiration, you know, for many of the characters that are on the page, you know, from his mother to attorneys that he worked with and women that he knew and the Hill Arts Society in particular, that group that really had an impact on his life.
And are there things from your own life that you identify with? Are there things that you're able to bring? I don't think there are too many of us that dropped out of school and just went to the library to learn, you know, about what they needed to know to go on in life. But are there things that you've experienced that help you relate to what August Wilson experienced in his life?
Oh yeah. I mean, I grew up in a segregated Texas. You know, so there are a number of parallels. I was raised with an work ethic. I was raised with a work ethic that said that I had to do 300% just to be noticed. And that was something that was instilled in me by black teachers because I never sat in a room with a white person until I was in the 10th grade.
Really?
But what was instilled in me were some principles. And an insistence on respect, you know, and being the best that I could. And I got love with my learning. I tell people that all the time in a segregated Texas schools. you know, and you know, I was smarter than most of those white kids at that school when I finally
no
integrated
doubt.
The school. But it was because I brought a different set, a different discipline, a different sense of self than I think even they expected. And, you know, so those kinds of parallels I have with August as an artist, you know, an aesthetic. And with principles, and you know, because my dad always said that nobody take your principles, you have to give those away. You know, and so I stick to my guns, so to speak, and that's another thing about August. You know, not only is he prolific, but whenever he writes, he doesn't stop at the first thought, and I think that's what's wonderful. He digs deep. And he challenges his characters to respond to situations that reveal the kind of character and depth and dignity and vulnerability that I think is wonderful, and that's what's attractive about his people.
We're talking with actor Eugene Lee, who stars as August Wilson in How I Learned What I Learned, which is playing at the Pittsburgh Public Theater, runs through April 5th. Also with us, director Todd Kreidler, who was August Wilson's collaborator over the course of many years. And Eugene Lee, as you prepared for this performance, this one-man show, what are some of the things that you looked into about August Wilson's life that helped inform you about how to play this character?
Well, yeah. I mean, everything I actually needed is on the page in this play in an interesting kind of way. I mean, I knew August, and some of these stories I have actually heard him do. I actually heard him do pieces of this in Roxbury in Boston at one point, and just sitting around in rehearsals and after rehearsals and stuff, I've heard a couple of these stories, you know. So my research to do this has been doing 8 of his 10 plays. If that makes sense.
Because that's how it got you into his head.
Yeah. And got him into my head. And you know, my familiarity with his language. And you know, and what we're trying to do here is not to mimic August in this production, not to try to sound like him, not to try to walk like him or talk like him, but in a strange way to try to, I like Todd's word, to conjure his spirit with his words, with his language, and with his characters. Because, you know, in many ways, that's how most people know August, is through his language and through his work. You know, so, you know, this is his work, and these are his words, and this is an account in a wonderful kind of way of the inspiration for much of what people like in those other plays of his.
Well, Todd Kreidler, you as a director, one of the first choices you made about this was that, August Wilson, it seems, based on all the film clips, which unfortunately is all we have left to go to, you always see him with a cigarette. And from what we hear, you know, from the people that knew him, he always pretty much had a cigarette in his hand. And yet, Todd, the first thing you cut out of the script is the smoking. Why is that?
That's a great question. First of all, you know, August had left me the piece to do, share with the estate. And it took me 10 years to wrap my head around that because I rejected it, you know, when he was still alive and wanted me to do it with an actor because it was something I had a hard time imagining. So one of the first things when it turned 10 years since we had done it initially, and sort of that decade sort of made me say, okay, I either need to do it or I need to let someone do it, but I can't hoard this, you know, final work. And one of the first things, the insight was, as I always say, we weren't going to do the Daniel Day-Lewis approach, that we were going to try to plumb and conjure August through the stories. And so I said, first thing, the cigarettes go. We even had cigarette jokes built into the show because he smoked during the show. So, you know, he had a joke like he said, when I agreed to do this one-man show, he said, I had two conditions, you know, one, that I have an understudy, and two, that they let me smoke. And then he'd light a cigarette and he'd say, well, they agreed to one of them, you know, and it was things like that that we built so he could smoke. So I said, let's get rid of that, because once you introduce that cigarette as a prop, then any actor, Eugene, is obligated then to begin to smoke like August, and then we get into physically trying to portray him. So I wanted to strip that away, and that's from a physical stance was I think the it was a gateway. And so then we've just followed that through. He still comes out. I mean, he's in the air. I mean, trust me, and people who have known him intimately and have seen Eugene do this, like, I mean, we get there, but we don't get there by a mimicry, if you know what I'm saying.
Sure, sure. But and Eugene, you're doing this by yourself. You're alone. It's a one-man show, so you're alone up there on stage. And it seems to be like the artistic version of performing a high wire act without a net. What is it like to get up there? And not just that you're doing one man, but the one man is August Wilson.
Oh, no, it's great, man. It's an honor, for one thing, to straddle the common denominators and to share those things. You know, I got this one instrument, and that's what I bring to whatever I do. But this is fun, man. This is to do August's work. That's some of the highlights of my career have been roles and characters that he's written in plays, and to get a chance to talk about the inspiration for those roles is a joy.
And talk about the staging here, Eugene. You have a lot of room to work with on that O'Reilly Theater stage, maybe more than room than you've had in other places that you've performed this piece.
No. Well, yeah, maybe a little more. I guess it's not that much. But, you know, I'm finding that with a piece like this and with the language that I have, I can, what's the expression? I can park and bark.
Yes, absolutely.
And you know, and the storytelling is, I think the storytelling is enhanced the less I move around and the more still I can be and tell these stories.
Yeah, I guess that was something that I thought that I was coming to, because whenever you see a film clip of an August Wilson interview, the man is so understated. So you have to bring this piece to life. You have to engage the audience, and yet you're trying to be true to some of what, or at least a lot of, at least just some of what the essence of the man is. And so are you kind of in this sort of delicate balancing act where you're trying not to make it too understood, at the same time not start chewing up the scenery?
Exactly right. Less is more often than not. I'm finding, yeah, and you know, and trust an audience to fill in, if that makes sense to you.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of surprises in the piece. Even when August did it originally, I mean, I watched him. As insane as this sounds, he was a 58-year-old, you know, two-time Pulitzer-winning, world-renowned playwright. But I watched him grow and push himself when he did this initially. So actually, there are performance elements. I mean, you're right in the understated thing, but he actually, and it's, you know, it's not anything we added. There are moments that are acted out or that embodied that actually August did. So there are opportunities for an actor. Also key to this is Eugene himself is a great writer. So Eugene brings a writer's mind to this, which has been just extraordinary for me to witness that sensibility coupled with the acting animal is just it's glorious from my seat.
Todd, how meaningful is this homecoming for you?
Oh, it's overwhelming. Every day something happens that I'm sort of resonates that, you know, not only do I have the privilege of bringing August home, but this is my home. I mean, I started my career at Pittsburgh Public Theater. You know, when I grew up 30 miles away, which could have been 1,500 miles away, I mean, I say that I couldn't even – New York wasn't even a seed in my head. I dreamed of Pittsburgh. I dreamed of going to school in Pittsburgh. Like, that was the city. I mean, I couldn't even get my head around New York or anywhere else in the country. And so when I got to – when I came here at Pittsburgh Public, I sat in my first – professional, you know, rehearsal with the stage manager who's stage managing how I learned what I learned. So I look at a Fred Noel and I was like, I mean, I'll never forget the heady day of my first professional, you know, rehearsal, you know, 17, 18 years ago. And to come back and work with Fred, an old colleague. So it's personally meaningful to me. It's also right outside the windows where this all started. And then, of course, this is August home. It's a, yeah, I could lay out the full title of the show, as I would say. August said, he said, man, he says, if it's just a one-man show, he said, we need a long title. And the full title of the show is How I Learned What I Learned and How What I Learned Has Led Me to the Places I Wanted to Go, Sometimes, unwillingly, it is the crucible in which many a work of art has been fired. So our stage is the crucible in which many a work of art has been fired. Pittsburgh is the crucible in which many a work of art is fired. So it's, yeah, I mean, this is glorious.
And you were quoted as saying, August Wilson is always on your shoulder. What did you mean when you said that?
There's a sensibility, a point of view, a mindset that I always have access to, and I don't mean that in a way, because I hate when people say, well, what would August Wilson think about this? Well, I can't, you know, that's I might have some ballpark, and maybe I don't engage in those conversations, but I sort of have the – I know the lens that he would look through the world, so I find that as a guide, his mentorship is ongoing, if that makes sense. And the lessons that he taught me, there are some things he taught me that I'm only finding out now. I'd be like, oh, my God, August tried to teach me that, and I missed it or I messed up on several occasions, and now it comes back. Or I look at instances in his own career, and then I've encountered those instances in my own and go back. So it's always a resource for me, if that makes sense. It's not, you know.
And I understand that you may – soon be working on a screen version of Fences.
Oh, I worked with August on two drafts years ago and you know, wrote some scenes.
Screenplay
with him.
Drafts.
Yeah, screenplay drafts. But that's, you know, those things are always out there. I mean, but there's nothing definite is come together.
Why is it, gentlemen, that there hasn't been more screen adaptations? Why there hasn't been more movies, screenplays, adaptations of August Wilson's work? You think there would be more out there?
I think there will be, and I say that both with some sense of not only things happening, but also I think what was key is that it was never August's objective. That was never his ambition. He was so committed to completing the cycle, so committed to the theater and developing them that he never put – and he had – I mean, I was with him. I mean, Hollywood was always calling him whether to do his plays or even – I remember meeting Russell Banks in Chicago, and Russell Banks had wanted August to adapt one of his novels. You know, it was – so – but August never had an interest, so he never put any of his energy into it. And so what's exciting now is I think two things are exciting about film possibilities. First of all, we have a wider breadth of audience. I'm working, you know, through the national August Wilson monologue competition to try to get these plays into the schools. So things like the recent documentary, film versions of the plays, all those things help that mission, which is exciting. But also it's I think the one thing that the films will bring that the stage doesn't is that August always writes about the community, the people he talks about and how I learned what I learned. And we could, you know, bring them to this. I mean, you would get to feel the community. And if you do Fences, you get to show a vibrant community of 55,000 people with four wallpaper and paint stores. And so things like that are exciting to me about what's ahead and what I think is ahead. But without, you know, it's not like I could say, well, Scott Rudin's lined this up and we're going into, you know, first day of shootings, blah, 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 blah. But those things are out there.
Well, let's hope. Let's hope. Well, something more to look forward to. Unfortunately, gentlemen, we're out of time, but this has been a really fun conversation. I'm glad you could be here. My guests have been the actor who stars as August Wilson in How I Learned What I Learned, Eugene Lee. Mr. Lee, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. It was a pleasure, man.
And director Todd Kreidler. The play is running through April 5th at the Pittsburgh Public Theater. Todd, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much.
And we have more Essential Pittsburgh coming up. Why the space program is taking CMU students to the desert. That's next here on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Coming up, we'll discover why CMU students are heading to the desert to explore space. But first, each week, 90.5 WESA celebrates Inventing Pittsburgh. The series explores the city's lesser-known history, connecting its past to its present.
It was early in the morning. The gentleman had gone in, I guess, to tend to his daily chores. There was a massive explosion, and he said all he remembers was a boom, and, you know, being tossed about 50 feet.
Darris Jeffcoat is the historian at St. Stanislaus Kostka Church, located 21st and Smallman Streets in the Strip District.
Well, thankfully, truly no one was injured.
At 2 a.m. on December 17, 1936, Pittsburgh Banana Company employee Peter Aletta reported for work. He turned on the lights in the gas-heated banana ripening room and then switched on an electric fan to circulate the air. Reports say a spark from the fan caused the accumulated gas to combust. It rained bananas.
The gas explosion was enough to literally blow out that entire wing of the building. 54 windows in the St. Stanislaus School had been blown out. For blocks around, other windows, you know, shattered, debris strewn everywhere.
The explosion was so loud, the fire department didn't even wait for a call. They just went looking for the source of the sound. They found Smallman Street covered in shards of glass and littered with rubble. St. Stan's two towers crooked at their tops. And Peter Aletta, he was alive, but buried up to his neck in brick and banana.
It was probably a pretty harrowing day for everyone involved.
Yes, of course, we have no bananas. We have no bananas today.
Yeah, this is presumably like a model banana ripening.
I'm John Soleri, associate professor in the Department of History at Carnegie Mellon University. I also direct the Global Studies program.
John Soleri has studied the rise of the banana as the everyman's fruit in the United States and the effects of that demand on Central and South American countries.
By the early 20th century, bananas had really ceased to be a novelty. By 1914, every person was eating as many as 22 pounds of bananas a year.
What enabled the banana to become the poor man's luxury is precisely what caused the Pittsburgh Banana Company to explode: controlled ripening.
The ripening room is important because the company's determined that ideally to control the ripening rate, you'd want to keep them at a certain temperature, basically around 60 degrees.
To ensure consistent delivery of perfectly ripe bananas, Pittsburgh Banana Company and other wholesalers built thick-walled rooms that were heated by gas in winter and cooled in summer.
That big parking lot is where the school building
neither St. Stanislaus School nor the Pittsburgh Banana Company still exist. But it certainly isn't for lack of trying. The explosion occurred on Thursday morning, and by Monday, students were back at school, their windows replaced by cement block. The Pennsylvania Railroad, the building's owner, started to rebuild and expand the following week.
The Strip District, I guess it was kind of that fatalism. When you live intimately with an industrial setting, you have to prepare for those inevitable things to happen. Tenement housing, gang rivalry, drugs, drinking, gambling, other explosions happened. So it was a brutal environment.
That's why St. Stanislaus was in the path of the blast wave anyway.
The churches did provide that kind of comfort and oasis in a harsh and difficult world. That reminder of home, but that testament to the faith that despite all these travails, tribulations, that the faith would sustain them.
St. Stan's front door still opens into the heart of the Strip District, catty-corner to the produce terminal building. You can easily find bananas in that part of town, for sale, instead of lying in the street.
Bananas raining out of the air, it is humorous. It did literally rain bananas in the Strip District.
For 90.5 WESA Celebrates Inventing Pittsburgh, I'm Margaret J. Krause.
90.5 WESA Celebrates Inventing Pittsburgh is supported by UPMC. Ask your Pittsburgh history question and find more stories online at wesa.fm/inventingpittsburgh. UPMC, life-changing medicine.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. This spring, students from Carnegie Mellon University will travel to the Mojave Desert in California to test the Zombie, a vertical takeoff, vertical landing rocket. Zombie is funded by NASA and will be used to explore craters on the surface of the moon. Neil Basin is a senior at Carnegie Mellon and led the development team. He joins us now in Studio A. Neil Basin, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Hi, thanks for having me.
First, let's have you explain what the Zombie rocket is.
Sure. So Zombie is a reusable test rocket made by Masten Space Systems. And as part of a NASA-funded project, our student team at Carnegie Mellon has built a robotic sensor that we will test on the Masten Zombie rocket. So what we've done is we've built a robotic sensor made of a bunch of cameras and a laser scanner. And it's about 40 pounds. It's a pretty hefty metal box with a bunch of sensors. And its primary purpose is to go on a lunar lander as part of the Astrobotic and Carnegie Mellon lunar landing mission. And what it does is when the lunar lander is getting close to the surface, it will scan the ground for craters and pits and try to build up a really high-quality 3D map of those surface features. So what this NASA project has allowed us to do is fund the development of this sensor package by Carnegie Mellon undergraduates. And it's also provided us this opportunity to test this sensor in the Mojave Desert on the Maston Zombie rocket.
And this rocket, it's described as a vertical takeoff, vertical landing rocket. I mean, it sounds like it's got some helicopter-type abilities.
Uh-huh. It's a pretty cool vehicle. It's a great test platform for us. It's not very tall. It's probably about 15 to 20 feet high, and it can fly for about a minute. It can take off and touch down, and they can control it very well. So what it lets us do is it lets us pretty much simulate what the action of the astrobotic lunar lander will look like in its final moments before landing on the moon. It gives us the shaking and the kind of flight profile that you can only get from a propulsive rocket. Previous to this upcoming test in the next month at the Mojave Desert, we tested our sensor package on a helicopter up in Zelianople at the little airport there. And that was really great for testing our project in a flight environment. But flying on a helicopter or an airplane is just not the same as a rocket. You can't hover the same way. You can't go straight up and straight down as quickly. And you can't sort of glide in the way that a rocket does. So this will be really great for testing our project in sort of as close to the lunar environment as we can get here on Earth.
If you have any comments or questions about the Zombie, about this particular research that's being done by CMU students, and for our guest Neil Basin, you can call us at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. This is Friday, after all. It is the day where we air Science Friday, so we're talking science. And what science does is generally tend to bring up all sorts of questions that you might have, and now is the time for you to ask those questions. Again, at 412-246-2002. Email address esspgh@wesa.fm and on Twitter at esspgh. How many sites did you consider before the Mojave Desert site came up, or did you know right away this is the place?
So as part of our project, we wrote a proposal to NASA to test our sensor. And as part of this program, NASA Flight Opportunities Office has a variety of platforms that they can sort of loan out to undergraduate teams for science projects. Some of the traditional test platforms are high-altitude weather balloons or sounding rockets that go close to the Earth's atmosphere. Or even platforms like a helicopter. The Maston rocket has been used for astrobotic tests in the past, and it's a pretty unique test environment. And the other thing is, this is actually the first undergraduate student project that NASA has funded to test on a reusable terrestrial rocket. So we looked at all of the different options, and we decided to propose that we wanted to test on the Maston Zombie rocket. But ultimately, it was NASA's choice to pick sort of what they saw as the most suitable test platform for our research project.
This is kind of nice for them, because for NASA, because, you know, there have been cutbacks. There is, there's some question about, there certainly are funding issues and questions about whether where money's coming from and whether money is even going to be available for something like this. So to have you guys go out and do it helps it helps you, but it helps them too, doesn't it?
Yeah, this is it's a pretty interesting project in that it's a $50,000 grant to our Carnegie Mellon team from NASA, which to me sounded like a lot of money when we started the project as an undergrad.
but
it turns out, you know, $50,000 is almost nothing in
right.
the scale of research grants and NASA projects. And by having this complete undergraduate team, we don't pay any people. We get heavy discounts when we ask really nicely from academic partners. And we've been able to build the entire sensor and pay for all of the testing campaign we've done so far with just that money. So I think it's really great that we've been able to show for NASA sort of what we can do with such a small amount of money. And I think that is really the Carnegie Mellon spirit coming through our project. CMU research is pretty well known to do much more for the same amount of money. It's kind of that spirit that we have to use whatever we need to use, whatever we can use to get the job done.
Yes, and CMU certainly has established a reputation as far as that goes. Are there any other universities working on comparable projects that you know of?
I know that in this sort of same round of projects as ours, it's called the Undergraduate Student Instrument Project. Educational Flight Opportunities. That's the full NASA name for our grant. And I believe there's about 11 other universities doing other science projects on flight vehicles. I believe we are the only project from that group that is testing on a reusable vehicle such as Zombie, but I know that there's a variety of scientific projects being tested on high-altitude balloons and sounding rockets.
You know, I can't tell you how amazing the concept of reusable sounds to someone of my particular age. When I was growing up and fascinated, as other kids were, by the space program, the Apollo program, the moon landing, which I'm old enough to remember seeing, all that stuff, you know, with the exception of the thing that they finally splashed down with, I mean, it all broke off. The rocket went up. Things were discarded. You couldn't even the whatever did happen to the original lunar module. I don't even know.
I believe it's some of the stuff is still there, right?
And, yeah, right. I guess we just left it up on the moon. So the idea that you can reuse this stuff is pretty incredible. And the rockets, as far as how high these test rockets you'll be working with, I mean, I'm guessing they go high enough to, you know, to the beyond Earth's gravitational pull, perhaps?
So the rocket that we're testing on can go about a mile high, I think.
So where does that put it? Is that like, you know, from there would you be able to, obviously you'd be able to see the curvature of the Earth, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can start to see it, and it's pretty amazing. I like what you said about the reusability as like it's a pretty amazing new concept, and Mastin has done a great job. I believe that they've tested or flown their rocket over 300 times, and I think we kind of have our own version of reusability in our sensor package. There's a large laser scanner that costs far too much for our $50,000 budget. but actually, our project advisor is Red Whitaker, who's done all sorts of projects at CMU in the past. And what he did was he just ripped that laser scanner straight out of the very first Sandstorm, the self-driving car. From about 10 years ago, they had this big laser scanner sitting on top of a red Hummer, and it's just been sitting in a garage now. So he went in and we ripped the laser scanner out of that, and we've been using it for free.
And as far as the development of the hardware, the software for this, I mean, I'm guessing that came before you approached NASA or not?
So there's been a few iterations here and there. Carnegie Mellon has a lot of history building autonomous surface vehicles, and there's some groups that build autonomous helicopters as well. Astrobotic has been working on a navigation landing sensor, and that sort of hardware package is sort of the previous iteration of what we're building here, which is a scientific modeling-focused sensor package. There's sort of a lot of heritage in this kind of setup, but we have designed and built, as part of this undergraduate project, our own unique robotic sensor.
And so this is all being developed for another mission to the moon and maybe beyond. Mm-hmm. Certainly Mars is in the picture. When is all this going to – we're down to about 30 seconds or so. We have a tweet. I'll finish that thought. Tweet from Ramneek. Wow. How are organizations like Google and SpaceX involved with CMU/NASA in the lunar lander mission?
So Google is funding the Google Lunar X Prize, And that's the big prize sort of at the end of the pipeline. And that's the $20 million award for the first private team to land on the moon.
And that's coming up soon, right?
Yeah. So the way the Google Lunar X Prize has currently been updated to work is that the goal is for one team or many teams to land on the moon by the end of 2016.
And this is like a mini device, right?
So the goal is to send a lunar lander with a rover on it to drive down and collect that X Prize.
So I guess that answers our question of when we're going to the moon. Sooner than we think.
Mm-hmm.
All right. We have to wrap this up. Neil Basin is a senior at Carnegie Mellon talking about the Zombie Project. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Thank you for listening to today's edition of Essential Pittsburgh. Have a great weekend, everyone. Until Monday.